Does it ever give the pause that men used to have a soul? Not by hearsay alone, but or as a figure of speech, but as a truth that they knew and acted upon. Verily, it was another world then, but yet it is a pity we have lost the tidings of our souls. We shall have to go in search of them again, or worse in all ways shall befall us. It's a passage from Thomas Carlyle's Past and Present, his ruminations as he wandered through the ancient monastery of St. Edmundsbury. Now, I'm not a regular or even an irregular reader of Carlyle. In fact, I came across this passage by chance in a novel which is titled The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. But I think from whatever source, the idea is striking. And it struck Will Thisbe, one of the characters in the novel, who remarks, "Isn't that something? To know your own soul by hearsay instead of by its own tidings. If I could believe I had a soul all by myself, then I could listen to its tidings all by myself." Can we believe that we have a soul in this age of neuroscience? Is there a place for it? Even more, is there a need for it? If we listen to Thomas Carlyle and Will Thisbe, we might think there is, lest worse in all ways befall us. Of course, before we can ask anything about the soul, we have to decide what it is, and that's a challenging question itself. Greek philosophers saw the soul as the source of movement in living things. Democritus thought it was spherical fire atoms, and Anaximenes said it was air. Plato emphasized the difference between soul and body, while Aristotle and his disciples, including Thomas Aquinas, began with the unity of the human person and saw the soul as substantial form. We'll have to come back to that idea. When Descartes rebooted philosophy in the 17th century, he spoke of mind rather than soul. Mind was thinking substance, while the body was extended substance. Since Descartes, English-speaking philosophy has tended to continue to speak of mind rather than soul. So neuroscience also tends to speak of mind and to ponder the mind-brain problem. Is there a place for the soul, whatever it is, in this age of neuroscience? The short answer is usually no. Neuroscience seems to be doing just fine without it. As William Utal says, two fundamental assumptions are likely to remain constant as the enterprise of neuroscience goes forward. The first is the basic idea of materialism. The second is that all mental processes are functions of that material reality. Without at least an implicit acceptance of these assumptions, it would be meaningless to pursue work in the field of neuroscience. We would have to accept the existence of a set of supernatural and uncontrolled variables that would make any experimental results meaningless. Established on such assumptions, neuroscience seems to be flourishing. Beyond its home base in biology, where it studies the brain and nervous system, it now partners with fields such as physics, chemistry, mathematics, medicine, computer science, and psychology. Its discoveries are simply mind-boggling. The numbers themselves are amazing. John Smithies gives a brief rundown. He says, "The brain consists of some 10 to the 10th neurons, with their many branching dendrites and axons, all interconnected by networks of unfathomable complexity, in which one neuron may be connected with tens or hundreds of thousands of other neurons. In each cubic millimeter of cortex, there are 1 billion synapses." Neuroscience sees the human brain as plastic. Its detailed structure and connections are somehow dependent on the particular experiences of the person who happens to own it, from birth, even before birth, through old age. The discoveries of neuroscience have been used to treat myriad pathologies, from the effects of stroke to obsessive-compulsive disorder. Neuroscientists have also been able to map various conscious activities to specific regions of the brain. Just last summer, Matthew Glasner and his colleagues reported in the journal Nature that new techniques have allowed them to map nearly 100 previously unknown brain regions. Well, despite these achievements, some fundamental questions still baffle neuroscientists. One is to explain how the observable and measurable activity of neurons in the brain results in consciousness. On this, Michael O'Shea says, "We have no idea. We have no idea how consciousness arises from a physical machine, and in trying to understand how the brain does that, we may well be up against the most awkward of scientific challenges." William Utah sees this as an intractable problem that neither new measuring devices nor computational engines can ever begin to unravel. David Chalmers argues that part of the dilemma may be the very materialistic assumptions of neuroscience itself. He says, "Any account given in purely physical terms will suffer from the same problem. It will ultimately be given in terms of the structural and dynamical properties of physical processes, and no matter how sophisticated such an account is, it will yield only more structure and dynamics. The existence of consciousness will always be a further fact relative to structural and dynamical facts, and so will always be unexplained by a physical account." A second fundamental question is to explain how consciousness, or intentionality, can affect the physical brain and so have an effect within the material world. The question is especially important for human freedom, to explain how our conscious free choices get enacted. Still more fundamentally, our understanding of human nature itself seems to require an account of the relation between the conscious mind and the material brain. As John Searle explains, "We have a conception of ourselves as conscious, intentionalistic, rational, social, institutional, political, speech act performing, ethical, and free will possessing agents. Now, the question is, how can we square this self-conception of ourselves as mindful, meaning-creating, free, rational agents with a universe that consists entirely of mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute physical particles?" It seems that in the wealth of discoveries of neuroscience, one important thing has vanished: the human person, you and I. We, you and I, are no longer real, unless we're willing to redefine ourselves as just an assemblage of neurons or a mere collection of brute physical particles. To some scientists, though, this seems like a happy prospect. So, the neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux says, "You are your synapses. They are who you are. Deal with it." And the psychologist Michael Gazzaniga explains, "The modern perspective is that brains enable minds, and that you is your vastly parallel and distributed brain without a central command center." Well, how do we begin to address such fundamental issues? I think in the end, we may have to resort to philosophy. And for that, we're going to need a philosopher. I suggest Dweezil Zappa. Now, you may know Dweezil. You can find his advice for us in the title of his 2006 album, Go With What You Know. We have to begin with what we know, with what we're aware of, with our experience. The Polish poet and Nobel Prize winner Czesław Miłosz has similar advice. In a collection of essays titled, To Begin Where I Am, he says, I am here. Those three words contain all that can be said, and so I must offer resistance, check every moment to be sure I am not departing from what I have actually experienced on my own, what I myself have touched. I can distinguish, I hope, between what is mine and what is merely fashionable. I cannot expel from memory the books I have read, their contending theories and philosophies, but I am free to be suspicious and to ask naive questions. We can also begin with our experience and distinguish it from the fashionable zeitgeist of our time known as materialism. We're free to be suspicious and even to ask naive questions. Fundamentally, we're free to affirm our experience of our consciousness and actions as non-negotiables, even as we appreciate the discoveries of neuroscience. If we start with and hold on to our own experience, we'll find ourselves in good company. Many scientists do the same. So the physicist and Nobel laureate Arthur Holly Compton writes, if the laws of physics should ever come to contradict my conviction that I can move my little finger at will, then all the laws of physics should be revised and reformulated. Or as the cognitive scientist Jerry Fodor says, if it isn't literally true that my wanting is causally responsible for my reaching, that my itching is causally responsible for my scratching, that my believing is causally responsible for my saying, if none of that is literally true, then practically everything I believe about anything is false, and it's the end of the world. Well, happily, we're not at the end of the world yet. Still, we should ask how it is that mind, which seems so self-evident, could be reduced so readily to the function of something else, to the physical firing of neurons in the brain. There must be some strong presuppositions at work here that lead to such a reduction. Perhaps, if we can sort them out, we'll be a step closer to finding not just a place, but also a need for the soul in this age of neuroscience. Well, as you can see, we're already down to point number four, so things are moving right ahead here. We'll look at the methods and assumptions of neuroscience. The achievements of neuroscience, like all empirical science, result from a strict adherence to the empirical method, which is limited, of course, to quantifiable, empirically verifiable data. Since a spiritual soul is not empirically verifiable, there is simply no place for it within the discipline of neuroscience. That need not mean, however, that there's no place for it in an age of neuroscience. To exclude the soul from the age of neuroscience, we'd have to extend the method of that science beyond the boundaries of that discipline to include all that is, all that exists. But the method of neuroscience would then no longer be just a method, a way of proceeding within a certain discipline. It would become a metaphysics, an assertion about everything that is. The legitimate methodological assumptions of the science would then be transformed into unfounded ontological assertions. Of course, it wouldn't be the first time that a scientific method was transformed into metaphysics. The same thing happened in the physical science and the philosophy that accompanied them at the time of the scientific revolution. At that time, the reductionistic method of physics became reductionism, The philosophical assertion that the most basic parts of the world are also the most real. The quantitative method of measurement became materialism, the belief that only the material and measurable is real. The practice of considering only quantifiable material causes in nature turned into naturalism. The metaphysical conviction that the world, precisely as science studies it, is all that is or can exist. The net result was not science, but scientism. In some ways, the presuppositions of scientism have become the foundational assumptions of our age. Jeffrey Swartz describes their effects on neuroscience. He says, "The cascade of discoveries in neuroscience has created an image of individuals as automata, slaves to their neurotransmitters, with no more free will than a child's wind-up toy." Well, how do we approach these dilemmas? Various things have been tried. We'll look at four approaches: materialism, emergence, dualism, and hylomorphism. And the last one will bring us back to Aristotle and Aquinas. So, materialism. In some ways, materialism offers the easiest, the simplest solution. Since matter is the only reality, the mind, like the brain, must be simply matter. And since matter can certainly act on matter, the mind can act on the brain. QED. One casualty of this approach, however, is human freedom. If all is matter and matter is deterministic, then freedom is impossible. Another more serious casualty is the human person as such, which is reduced to a collection of atoms. While recognizing the inadequacy of reductionistic materialism, some thinkers have invoked the notion of emergence to explain the mind-brain relation. As the property of wetness emerges from a collection of water molecules, none of which individually you could splash around in or say is wet, well, so the mind emerges from brain activity, yet manifests properties that cannot be reduced simply to brain function. And there are two versions of emergence known as weak emergence and strong emergence. In weak emergence, or epiphenomenalism, the mind is considered a real product of brain activity, but one that doesn't exercise any causal influence on the brain. In effect, the mind is simply an alternative description of brain activity. In strong emergence, the mind is said to exercise a downward causality, a top-down causality on the brain. The nature of that influence, however, especially the kind of causality it might involve, remains rather obscure. While claiming that a whole, such as a human being, emerges from its parts, emergence provides no ontological principle to explain or ground the being of the whole, and so remains in constant danger of falling back again into reductionism. The mind is said to emerge from cerebral processes, but seems to be ontologically nothing other than a collection of just those processes. Dualism is another alternative. It sees the human being as a combination of two radically different things: a material thing, the body, and a spiritual thing, the mind. Some neuroscientists, such as John Eccles and Wilder Penfield, have been drawn to dualism through a lifetime of reflection on the mind-brain problem. So John Eccles writes, "This dualist conclusion is the culmination of my lifelong dedication to the self-brain problem." And Wilder Penfield says, "For myself, after a professional lifetime spent in trying to discover how the brain accounts for the mind, it comes as a surprise now to discover, during this final examination of the evidence, that the dualist hypothesis seems the more reasonable of the two possible explanations. Now, dualism has the advantage of being able to affirm the reality of the mind unequivocally, but it has difficulty in showing how mind and body together constitute one being, one human person. The temptation is therefore to identify the human being simply with the mind by discounting the body. Dualism also finds it hard to explain how the mind influences the brain and vice versa, since it sees them as two distinct substances. On this problem, Yeogwon Kim says, "I believe that the problem goes deep, deep into our fundamental metaphysical views about ourselves and the world we live in, and that we need to make fairly drastic adjustments if we are serious about coming to terms with this problem." Well, I suggest we might begin to adjust our contemporary metaphysical views by retrieving something of the hylomorphic theory of Aristotle and Aquinas. Through it, we may find a place and even see the need for the soul in this age of neuroscience. So we're on to hylomorphism. Hylomorphism allows us to maintain both the reality of the mind and the integrity of the human person as a single being. It sees the human being as composed of two principles, but not, as in dualism, two substances. The principles are called matter, hyle in Greek, and form, morphe. Matter, or hyle, as used here, is not a kind of stuff, an actual substance like a bunch of atoms. Rather, it's the mere possibility of being something or other. And form is not just a shape or a structure, it's the principle by which a thing is the kind of thing that it is. In living things, the principle of form is called soul. Together, these two principles comprise not two beings, as in dualism, and not just a quasi sort of whole, which is really just a collection of other stuff, as in reductionism or emergence, but one being. Put the terms together, hyle and morphe, and you have the word hylomorphism. Put the actual ontological principles together, and you have a single substance, such as a single human being. Now, this may be familiar to some of you, old hats, if you've had the introductory class in Aristotle, but for others, I'll try to give you a quick fix on what hylomorphism is all about, okay? I do this over a two-semester period when I'm in Berkeley, but maybe the students here are quicker, so we'll be in luck. I invite you to picture Bobby. He's a 10-year-old boy. Now, Bobby gets a puppy for his birthday, and he names it Rover. Not the most imaginative kid, but in any case, he's delighted that he has his puppy. But 3 days later, his puppy runs out into the street and gets smashed by a cement mixer. So it's over for Rover. Sorry about that. Rover is now just a blob on the pavement, and poor Bobby is disconsolate. Still, Bobby's dad tries to help. Now, unfortunately, Dad happens to be a reductionist. So he says to little Bobby, "Don't worry, son. Rover's still here, right here on the pavement. There's nothing missing, all his parts there. He's just had his parts rearranged." Well, little Bobby knows better. Whatever made Rover to be Rover is over. Couldn't resist. This isn't just a reshaping of parts. Something more radical has happened, something substantial, what Aristotle would call substantial change. Change all around us. You see it all the time. Just watch this. The paper was flat, and it became background. Change. Amazing. I see you're not impressed. Well, I think this example gives us something to hold on to, though. If you think about it, any change you're going to come across is always going to involve something that stays the same and something new. So here the paper, which is a substance, stays the same and gets a new shape. Aristotle would call this accidental change. The substance stays the same, the accidents, the shape changes. But what happens in the substance itself changes? If substance itself is changing, it can't be substance that stays the same. It's got to be something more basic, more fundamental. Rover was a substance, a dog, a being. So when that being, that substance changed, when Rover died, substance could not have been what stayed the same, unless, of course, Rover never really was a single substance, a single being, but was always only a collection of other substances, of other stuff. But in that case, Rover never really was Rover, and Dad is right. Even after the accident, Rover is still here, right here on the pavement. He's just had his parts rearranged. The way a deck of cards is still a deck of cards, even after you've reshuffled it. But if substance is really substance, if Rover is really Rover, if the substance changes, it can't be the substance that remains the same. But it's not the substance, or a collection of substances, a bunch of stuff. What is it? Aristotle's answer is what he calls mere possibility of being, hyle, or primary matter. In hylomorphism, any material substance is composed of two principles. One is the mere possibility of being, primary matter, and this explains why the substance can cease to be what it is and become something else. Every material substance always has this possibility of being something else, as wood has the possibility of being or becoming ash. The other principle is substantial form, the principle by which the substance is the kind of thing that it is, the principle by which Rover is a dog, by which Rover is Rover. Neither primary matter nor substantial form is itself a thing, a substance. Each is rather a principle of substance, and only together do they constitute a complete substance. Now, in living things, the form is called soul. So, in living things, whether dog or cats or humans, soul and primary matter, possibility of being, are not two things, but together are a single living thing, a substance. So, if, even in this age of neuroscience, dogs are still dogs and cats are still cats, and not just collections of other stuff, then each must have a substantial form or soul. And if a human being is a human being and not just a collection of other stuff, then each human must also have a substantial form, a soul. For anything we come across in the world, we can ask, what is it? Some things, like log cabins or skyscrapers, will turn out to be just collections of other stuff, much as building materials that get structured in a certain way. Before, during, and after the skyscraper is built, its steel girders are still steel. But other things, like Rover, like dogs and cats and people, exhibit a degree of unity, a distinctive activity, and a kind of behavior that leads us to recognize each of them as a whole, not just a collection of parts or a collection of other stuff. If that's our intuition, then we need an ontological principle, call it whatever you like, to explain that unity, that oneness. We need a principle to explain why all of the parts of Rover are really Rover and not just other stuff. Why all the parts of me, all the parts of you, whether carbon or nitrogen or whatever, do not exist as other stuff. In each one of us, they exist as you or as me. This principle is what Aristotle calls substantial form, or in living things, soul. This means that the soul is not an add-on, kind of little homunculus, that we can easily do without. It's not a ghost or a spirit. It's a physical principle of each living thing that makes it to be the kind of thing it is, which actualizes or determines possibility of being to be a particular kind of thing. So, in this philosophy, the whole does not emerge from a collection of parts. Rather, the substantial form or soul as the principle of the whole explains the existence and structure of the parts. In effect, the whole does not depend on the parts, as in emergence, but the parts depend on the whole. Thomas Aquinas explains this, and you'll find the quote on your handout if you want to follow along. Now, the substantial form perfects not only the whole, but each part of the whole. For since a whole consists of parts, a form of the whole which does not give existence to each of the parts of the body is a form consisting in composition and order, such as the form of a house, or we might say the form of a skyscraper, and such a form is accidental. The log cabin has a certain structure, but that structure doesn't give existence to the logs. The soul is a substantial form, and therefore it must be the form and the act not only of the whole, but also of each part. The substantial form gives being to the whole. It causes the whole to exist as that kind of thing rather than as a collection of other stuff. In causing the thing to exist as a certain kind of thing, the substantial form or soul accounts for the existence and structure of all the parts. So, Rover has bones and heart and nose and tail because of his substantial form. By causing a thing to be what it is, the substantial form also accounts for all of the thing's characteristic actions. So, dogs bark and ducks quack and humans think, all in virtue of their particular substantial form. Now, once things exist and have a characteristic way of acting, then empirical science can study those activities, quantify them, see their interrelationships. It can also codify its findings into scientific laws. But such laws are always descriptive and not prescriptive. They describe the behavior of things quantitatively. They never prescribe or cause such behavior. As an empirical science, neuroscience studies the activity of the human brain, but it can do so only because, at a more fundamental level, a human being is a human being existing as one being that has certain characteristic activities, including brain activities, in virtue of the substantial form or soul by which it is a human being. Now, neuroscience doesn't study the soul since it lies outside of its methodological limits. So there is no place for the soul in neuroscience, and neuroscience rightfully ignores it, or should ignore it since it's beyond the competence of its method, however much neuroscientists like to comment on reality or unreality of the soul. Still, without the soul, there would be no human being, and so no human brain for neuroscience to study. Beyond the methodological limits of neuroscience, however, there is a place for the study of the soul in the philosophy of nature and philosophical anthropology, which don't contradict, but rather complement the work of neuroscience. So how does hylomorphism help us with mind-brain interaction? Hylomorphism offers a coherent framework for understanding the mind-brain relation. The first advantage it has over other options is that it begins with the whole human being rather than the parts. It's not the part that explains the whole, but the whole that explains the part. Secondly, hylomorphism begins with the whole human person as the subject who acts, rather than attributing action to some particular part of the person. This puts the discussion of the part, such as the brain, always in the context of the whole. Thirdly, once the reality of the whole is established as the subject of action, we can then go on to consider how the subject, the individual person, might use one part to act on another, as I might use my hand to scratch my head. At this point, however, hylomorphism also makes a broader understanding of action and causality itself available. Causality isn't reduced to the force that moves the atom, and we're not reduced to considering how the mind can exert such a physical force on the brain. Broader notions of formal and final causality, as well as principal and instrumental causality, aspects of efficient causality, can be employed to give a more complete, integral account of human action at every level. Well, we're down to number 7, which rhymes with heaven, huh? And we're going to consider human immortality. Before concluding, I'd like to say a brief word about how principles of hylomorphism also allow us to account for human immortality without sacrificing the unity of the human person. We start with the philosophical principle that action follows being. What a thing does tells us about what it is. So, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, chances are it's a duck. Its action tells us about it. Now, some of the characteristic actions of human beings suggest immateriality. Humans, for instance, are capable of self-reflection and intellectual abstraction. But if we transcend the limits of material action of materiality in our actions, such as the act of knowing, we must also transcend materiality in our being, because action follows being. The soul is the principle of human action. So if human action transcends materiality in some way, the soul must also transcend materiality. If so, the human substantial form is unlike the substantial form of any other material thing. The substantial forms of all other substances cease to be when the substance ceases to be. Since the human substantial form, soul, transcends materiality, it may continue to exist even without its material co-principle of possibility of being or primary matter. In this continued existence, however, the soul is not a complete human being. Since humans are rational animals, they essentially require matter as well as form for their completeness. Aquinas therefore teaches that after death, before the resurrection, the separated soul is not itself a human person, an individual substance of a rational nature, according to Boethius' definition, but only part of a person. So you have this quotation also on the handout. Not every particular substance is a hypostasis or a person, but that which has the complete nature of its species. Hence, a hand or a foot is not called a hypostasis or a person, nor likewise is the soul alone so called, since it is a part of the human species. Since action follows being, the action of the separated soul as part of the human being will be different from the action of the whole human being composed of both soul and matter. So, when I talk or wave my hand, it's I, the complete human being, who's doing that. Such action is radicated in the soul, but by which the human is human, but it belongs to the whole human being, which is the union of both form and matter. This means that in the complete person, in each one of us presently, the intellect or mind does not act independently of the brain, even though some of its activities may transcend the materiality of the brain. A thing acts according to the way that it is, and the complete human being is not merely soul, but the integral union of soul and matter. So, Aquinas teaches that presently, the immaterial intellect does not act apart from the body. It cannot, for instance, even form an idea, a concept, a universal notion like elephant or rose that applies to every elephant and every rose without employing some image or phantasm of a particular elephant or rose. So if I say a word to you like butterfly, immediately you have the idea of butterfly in your intellect, you know what a butterfly is, but not without the image of some particular butterfly or other in your imagination. A yellow one or blue one, one kind or another will be in your imagination. Although the intellect and the imagination work together, Aquinas sees the intellect as an immaterial power, while he sees the imagination as a physically based power centered in the brain. He sees all of the internal senses like imagination as powers that are centered in the brain. So for Aquinas, the mind in this present life does not act apart from the brain. This philosophical conclusion accords with current brain research, showing that every act of knowing or willing is accompanied by brain activity. By the same philosophical principle that action follows being, we have reason to say that after death, once the human soul has an existence or being apart from matter, it will then be able to act, to know, and to will without its co-principle. However much, the soul is still an incomplete human being without that co-principle of matter. Aquinas argues that since action follows being, if the soul exists without its material principle, it will also be able to act without that principle. Now this, of course, has theological implications for the Christian notion of immortality and resurrection. If the separated human soul by itself, before the resurrection of the body, were unable to know or to love, it could not enjoy the beatific vision of God. On the other hand, if the human soul were equated with the human person, there would seem to be little philosophical reason for a resurrection involving in some way a reuniting of soul and matter or possibility of being. So we come to the conclusion, to begin where I am. Each of us begins with the experience of herself or himself as an integral human being. We experience ourselves as whole persons, and we marvel, as the psalm says, that we are fearfully, wonderfully made, that our whole being acts for the good of each part, and each part acts for the good of the whole. Hylomorphism allows us to identify the substantial form or soul as the ontological ground of our wholeness. If our experience in the world, our interaction with other people, our introspection, our life of faith, leads us to the conviction that we are spiritual as well as physical, then hylomorphism allows us to account for these dimensions of ourselves without sacrificing our wholeness. Finally, if human wholeness is our starting point, if the soul is the ground of our wholeness, and if the full achievement of wholeness is our end, then we can surely recognize our need to affirm the reality of the soul in this age of neuroscience. Perhaps we can conclude with a few more words from Carlyle, even beyond what you'll find in the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Does it never give thee pause that men then had a soul, not by hearsay alone and as a figure of speech, but as a truth that they knew and practically went upon? Verily it was another world then, but yet it is pity we had lost tidings of our souls. Actually, we shall have to go in quest of them again, or worse in all ways will befall. Another world, truly. And this present poor, distressed world might get some profit by looking wisely into it instead of foolishly. These old St. Edmundsbury walls, I say, were not peopled with phantasms, but with men of flesh and blood, made altogether as we are. Had thou and I then been, Who knows but we ourselves had taken refuge from an evil time and fled to dwell here and meditate on an eternity in such fashion as we could. For 20 generations, here was the earthly arena where painful living men worked out their life wrestle, looked at by earth, by heaven and hell, bells tolled to prayers, and men of many humors, various thoughts, chanted vespers, matins, and round the little islet of their life rolled forever, as round ours still rolls, even though we are blind and deaf, the illimitable ocean, tinting all things with its eternal hues and reflexes, making strange prophetic music. He that speaks what is really in him will find men to listen, though under never such impediments.